scrupulously in the modern international law of human rights. Therefore, the two international human rights conventions, which came into force in 1976, while primarily oriented towards individual rights in the major traditions of United States human rights law and French human rights law, those conventions both begin with the statement of the right of self-determination of peoples, a collective political right recognized outside of the institutional framework that is handling decolonization within the United Nations at this point. In other words, the area of self-determination outside of formal decolonization now recognized is an area of international law at the UN level without a responsible, competent body other than those in the human rights field. The other factor in terms of this law of human rights is that the only international recognition at this point in conventional international law of the rights of minorities is Article 27 of the International Covenant of Civil and Political Rights, which came into force in 1976. Again, while that's I certainly call it a group rights section, while it is a group rights, minority rights section, it again is put in the context of the international law on human rights. So the international law of human rights is often rejected by indigenous populations as an inadequate framework for the articulation of their goals because of its presumed individual rights orientation. In general, that is true, but the international law of human rights, as it's developed over the last 10, 20 years, has included elements which indigenous peoples, in fact, have used and are compatible. Just one final point. The structure of the United Nations is one in which rights may now be recognized on levels other than that of the nation state, there's still very little in the way of a departure from the structure of the United Nations in which only nation states are the actors. Nevertheless, even on this point, there has been some movement. And the recognition of the Palestine Liberation Organization and SWAPO as having observer status is a clear departure from the premise that only recognized nation states can be involved in the formal structure of United Nations bodies.
Thank you, Doug, for that masterly analysis of recent and not so recent developments in international law. Well, Mr. Henke, we turn to you now, sir,
Mr. Chairman, I have just a footnote to this erudite exposition by Douglas Sanders. Although I am a citizen of the United States and live in Amherst, Massachusetts, I now speak as an informal member of the Hispanic tribe. I don't know whether by international law one can belong to two tribes. Is that possible? If so, I do. I now speak to make certain that Spain and Hispanic contributions are properly recognized when it comes to international law. There was a book published about a half century ago by James Brown Scott, then director of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, entitled The Spanish Origin of International Law. He'd been to Salamanca, had studied the published works of Francisco de Vitoria, and in other ways he argued that the true basis for international law had been constructed by Spain. So much so that when I had the problem of getting a book published, young historians often have a difficult time getting their valuable contributions to learning published, I turned to Dr. Scott because I discovered in the Spanish archives a whole volume of unpublished treatises on the rights of Spain to the New World, on the relations of Spain to the Indians, natives of the New World, not only America, but also in the Philippines. And there was Dr. Scott willing to put up, I think, $500 to get this Cuerpo de Documentos published in Spanish in Mexico. Unfortunately, it came out in 1943 during the war. Very bad paper. Nobody's read it. But there you will see not only questions relating to territory, which was one of the important focuses of Douglas Sanders, but all various aspects of relations between peoples. And remember, they were the ones who first met the peoples of the New World from Europe. And they didn't discuss merely these arcane subjects, which sometimes our international lawyers do, but realities. For example, there was Alonso Sanchez, a Jesuit. He published several treatises. He was very hot against the Muslims in the Philippine Islands. And he said, with respect to these ancient enemies of Spain, who attacked Christian Spain during the Middle Ages and occupied Spain, we should declare only war by fire and by sword. Not only was there a whole volume of treatises, but I'd found enough references to other treatises. So I prepared a bibliography year by year of every treatise I'd heard about which concerned these questions. Well, and after this volume came out, a very distinguished Jesuit scholar today, Ernest Burris, published a splendid edition of the treatise, or rather the university lectures by the Augustinian Alonso de la Vera Cruz, professor at the University of Mexico, on all these questions following Las Casas. So that I just want to make certain that this body does not forget that when the difficult problems of relations between Europe and the peoples of the New World in the Philippines are studied, they must take into account the Spanish contributions.
Thank you, sir. Clem Charche, you're going to have to leave tonight, I gather, so please feel free to give us your views now.
Thank you, Mr. Commissioner. Just want to preface my remarks by stating that for those that have read the, I'm not sure what it's called, the description of the expected participants, Mr. Douglas Sanders, of course, is put down here as, amongst other things, legal counsel for the World Council of Indigenous Peoples. Just want to mention that Mr. Sanders has been with the World Council prior to its formation and since its formation, and the work that he does, of course, he charges nothing for. Just want to state that the advice that we get is not reflective of that fact. Anyway, with that, Doug has given quite an overview of the international law and developments, and what I will do is try to give some overview of what the World Council of Indigenous Peoples is attempting to do and some of our future initiatives. To begin with, we make it clear and have stated that the United Nations, the international community, has to deal with the fact that there are Indigenous peoples. There is an Indigenous world. Some people call it the Fourth World. Some people call it other things, but nevertheless, we are there and we have to be dealt with by the international community. The other fact, of course, is that the Indigenous peoples themselves will be the ones that will set and will have to be the ones and will be the ones to set the basis of future international law, which will accommodate us within the international community. Any of the issues, conflicts, can only be resolved internationally by the determination by ourselves of our future. Yeah, so I think that's the basic premise, at least, that the World Council of Indigenous Peoples is basing our work on. Where is this work being done? I think it's right to say that we have to do this work both internationally and nationally. Now, since my election in September of last year, I have had opportunity to do some traveling, and I'll speak with respect to the experience I've had since that time. Nationally, of course, we have the situation in Nicaragua, which has been dealt with over the past 3 days. There you see a situation where the Indian peoples are dealing with the government of the country and are seeking ways in which their right to self-determination will be expressed in a relationship with the rest of the country. I think the hope is that there will be a treaty concluded and that that treaty will be reflected in the new constitution of that country. So I think that's a significant development. We have the situation in Canada where the Aboriginal peoples of Canada, the Indian, Inuit, and Métis peoples, are negotiating with the leaders of the country, the 10 premiers and the one prime minister at the highest political level. There, the Aboriginal peoples are seeking their rights to self-determination in the ways that they feel best suits their needs. But again, it's within the context of the country, at least those indigenous peoples that are involved in that process. You have the situation in Norway where the Sami people have been instrumental in getting two commissions set up. One is a commission on Sami rights, the other is a commission on Sami culture. The commission on Sami rights has made its report. It's been published. It's about 700 pages. The unfortunate thing is it's in Norwegian. I can't read it. There is a summary, however, of it in English. I've had an opportunity to glance through that. I've also had an opportunity to speak to government peoples with respect to that report, as well as to the Sami people themselves. That is quite an extensive report by the commission. It deals with the possibility of and the desirability of amending the constitution of Norway to reflect Sami rights. As well, there's a total chapter devoted to international law and Sami rights. Now, I haven't had a chance, as I say, to analyze that chapter in total. I do know that they give a lot of emphasis to the issue of minority rights under the covenants, especially section or article 27, and I think tend to rely on that as being the basis of Sami rights as opposed to the naked right of self-determination itself. But nevertheless, at least that country and the Sami people are going through the exercise of debate, and that's always helpful. Then we have the situation that is in front of us today. Here in Alaska, we have the Native Alaska Review Commission. This also is another forum which gives the Indian peoples, the Inuit peoples, the indigenous peoples of Alaska an opportunity to express desires, aspirations, and statements of rights. And again, that's important. The work of this commission, I'm sure, will go a long way in debating future developments or standards, both of national law and international law. So it's important that, again, work be done at the national level. Now, I know, if I can use Canada as an example, that's where I live, that we won't see developments as progressively as we'd like to see them, but nevertheless, again, it's a forum of debate, a forum of discussion, and that debate, of course, is reflected in the institutions of the United Nations. We as well have to debate internationally. Those same national governments are involved at the international community and, in a sense, try to justify statements at the international level that they're either making or not making at the national level and vice versa. So it's an opportunity for us to play the game at its ultimate and to make people accountable for statements that are made both internationally and nationally. And also it's an opportunity for us to police statements made by, in my case, countries like Canada that put themselves out as the champions of human rights internationally, but yet sort of turn a blind eye to situations in Canada itself. So it gives us a good opportunity to play that role. As Doug was stating, there has been developments at the international level. The Working Group on Indigenous Populations was created. I personally had an opportunity to participate in the first and second sessions in 1982 and 83, so I have a bit of knowledge as to how it is functioning or not functioning. One of the major purposes of that working group is to develop standards for guiding the international community in its relationship with indigenous peoples or populations as they describe us. And I think that, again, is an important exercise, and it enables or allows people like myself and other indigenous delegates to express ourselves in a forum. It's sort of the lowest forum available internationally, but at least it's a forum that's devoted specifically to debating this issue. It's a small start, but nevertheless, it is a start. One of the significant developments, I believe, is the decision. I think there was a decision made. It was close to being made when I left Geneva, that the working group session in 1985 would begin the discussion and drafting of standards with respect to the rights of indigenous peoples, and this year's drafting would begin with respect to land. Last year's session dealt with the agenda item land and resources and definition of indigenous peoples or populations. The latter agenda item didn't go very far, but there was some wide-ranging discussions on land. And if things go as expected, there will be some preliminary discussion and drafting with respect to the indigenous peoples to land. So I think that's significant, and it allows indigenous organizations an opportunity to help develop that kind of phraseology which we would want to see reflected in international law. One of the other things that's of significance that's developing within the United Nations is a potential covenant on the rights of the child. And one of the things that we've ensured and brought attention to is that when any convention is brought forward or covenant is brought forward, that there be specific reference to the right of the indigenous child to be brought up within their own culture and within their own communities. So that is something that we will continue working on. With respect to the United Nations, you also have what are known as specialized agencies. We mentioned earlier the ILO, the International Labor Organization. Now, the World Council of Indigenous People has taken the view that the ILO Convention on Indigenous and Tribal Peoples, whatever the name of it is not acceptable as it is assimilationist. However, the ILO is looking at the possibility of redrafting the covenant, particularly their reference to the indigenous and tribal peoples, and have invited our active participation with respect to that. So over the next 3 to 5 years, however long it takes, we will be actively involved with members of the ILO to draft something which we feel will adequately reflect our aspirations. And it seems that they're willing to give wide latitude to that participation. And there seems to be a willingness to, in fact, amend the ILO convention. Just another organization or another initiative that I stumbled across. We don't pretend to know everything. We have a lot to learn, and we are attempting to learn. But there's an organization called the Independent Commission on International Humanitarian Issues, and that was created by virtue of a General Assembly resolution, not as a specialized agency or as a creature of the General Assembly, but I suppose something more like an international think tank, which is to report back to the General Assembly in 1986. As I say, I didn't know anything about it. I did go to their office when I was in Geneva several weeks ago, and found out that they are dealing with 6 to 8 issues. One of the issues is indigenous peoples, and there is a specific person assigned to that that topic. She feels that in the end result there might be 2 or 3 pages of the report devoted to indigenous peoples because the commissioners really aren't really concerned or totally aware of indigenous peoples, but are looking at other areas like the environment or humanitarianism, things of that nature. But we informed her that, yes, we, as the World Council of Indigenous Peoples, will want to be involved in this development, and we said we would take it upon ourselves to ensure that the commissioners, in fact, decide to give greater emphasis to this particular part of the report. So that's another area that we'll be looking at. On a more practical side, there are things that we can do to start preparing ourselves and I guess preparing the international community to accept our deliberations and our suggestions. First of all, at our General Assembly, the World Council has set up several commissions. We have 2 commissions, one on the situation of the Indians in Guatemala, another commission on the reunification of the Mosquito family. We feel that by getting involved directly in these issues, we not only bring the World Council to the international community's attention, but we bring the, and I guess more importantly, we bring the issue to the international community. And I think by doing this, we show the international community that indigenous peoples are in fact able to deal with issues and as well are in fact sincere in the things that we say, things like the right to self-determination, the right to land, and the right to life. Another commission that we have is a commission to draft an international convention or covenant on the rights of indigenous peoples. The commission is basing its work on a declaration of principles on indigenous rights, which was adopted by our 4th General Assembly. And we're hoping to give as wide a distribution to this declaration as possible and to solicit as wide a range of views with respect to the future covenant as possible. So the commission hasn't begun active work yet. We're still in the process of getting it in place and getting the resources to do the necessary work. But we are, at the same time, looking at ways we can give it wider distribution in terms of involvement. In this connection, again, the General Assembly made it quite clear to the executive of the World Council that we must ensure that the women are involved in the World Council of Indigenous Peoples movement. And in that connection, we are striving and are making some headway in ensuring that there is a significant women's delegation at the Nairobi conference to end the decade on the woman. With respect to another initiative, we want to ensure that the views of the youth are known in terms of the rights of indigenous peoples and rights that should be reflected in the covenant. We are working and have organized, in fact, an international indigenous youth conference, which will be held in July of this year in Saskatchewan, Canada. So we're trying to ensure that all segments and sectors of the indigenous world are heard and play a role, an active role, in future developments. We feel that as much as possible, we have to get the views of everyone. Now, there are sources from which we can draw upon, and one of them, of course, are the hearings, are the transcripts of the hearings from this commission and hopefully the report. I'm sure the recommendations contained in the report will give a lot of meat towards the development of our covenant with respect to rights. The other initiative that we're undertaking is more in-house for indigenous peoples. We're working in conjunction with several other international non-governmental organizations, indigenous organizations, to set up a training program in Geneva this summer prior to the next session of the Working Group on Indigenous Populations. The Inuit Circumpolar Conference, our organization, the Indian Law Resource Center in Washington, D.C., and hopefully several others will get together to ensure that this training program does come off and that it does take into account the things that are necessary for us to develop ourselves to continue this struggle at the international level. As well, in conjunction with that, we will be organizing a pre-sessional meeting. We found in the past that because of the tremendous amount of work that all organizations have to face, both at home and nationally and internationally, that we sometimes don't have enough resources and don't spend enough human resources and financial resources to be able to prepare adequately for conferences. Over the past three working group sessions, we have gotten together during the session itself, but last year there was finally a determination made that we have to get together prior to the working group session, and we now plan on getting people together about the 4 or 5 days prior to the working group session so that the indigenous peoples can get together, discuss our common issues, and possibly come up with some common strategies and some common principles which we'll put forward at the working group session and go there as united as possible on certain general broad principles.
You mean the annual working group sessions in Geneva?
Yes.
Yeah.
So that's something that we're looking at. I just wanted to get back maybe just very quickly to this notion of minorities and peoples. That's one that's that's a sensitive issue for politicians, indigenous politicians. We state that we're not merely minorities. We are a people with a right to self-determination. We say that the covenants and other international expressions, laws, don't state all peoples except indigenous peoples have the right to self-determination. So as a people, we say that we have the right to be self-determining. But as the Indian Law Resource Center book points out, there are certain rights afforded by the Covenant, Section 27, the rights of minorities, and in the interim, we should use what's there. One example is in Canada, Sandra Lovelace, a Maliseet Indian who lost her rights under the Indian Act, took an action to the Human Rights Committee and in fact was successful. The Human Rights Committee found that Canada did violate the covenant in that it denied her the right to live on the reserve in order to continue her cultural affinity with the land and with her people. So in that sense, it was a useful tool, but we say that we can't stop there, that we have to continue and get the full right that we see as being ours. The World Council, as I say, was in Geneva, and during the period of time that I was there, I made two oral presentations. They are written out and they are available on the information table at the back. And rather than go into some of the things I said there, people could pick them up and maybe glance through them later. I think what's important now is, what are we going to do from here on? I'd like to say that and believe that the World Council of Indigenous Peoples and the Inuit Circumpolar Conference have done a good job with this joint initiative. I think this, as I stated, the report that will come out of this, I believe, will go a long way in helping as another very important instrument in developing further discussions with respect to the rights of indigenous peoples internationally. I think we have to continue this kind of cooperative effort, and one of the ways that I see this taking place is the possibility of a continuing sort of relationship at the international level in which we can do some joint work. One of the things that I see as an opportunity is, one of the things that is necessary is to have a permanent and a high profile within the United Nations. Currently, because of the emphasis on human rights and because that's where we currently can make our biggest impact, we have decided that we should have an office in Geneva. And I think the ICC and the WCIP could set up a joint office and work at influencing international sentiment, international developments within that system. Doug Sanders also made reference to the fact that SWAPO and the Palestinian Liberation Organization, who are not nation states, have observer status in the United Nations. I think one of the things that the indigenous peoples should do, not necessarily the World Council of Indigenous Peoples, but the indigenous community, the indigenous world, I think we as indigenous people should look at the possibility of, in fact, gaining at least observer status within the United Nations as a first step. I think we should, as indigenous peoples, have full rights within the United Nations. I'm not sure how we could make that kind of accommodation at now, but I think that's something we can aspire to. But as an interim measure, we should have observer status. Now, I think that would, of course, necessitate the international non-governmental organizations, indigenous organizations, getting together and finding some kind of framework within which we could make that a reality or make that possible. That's, I think, something else we should be working towards. But anyway, to sum up so we can give other people a chance here before the topic closes, it's clear that all of the statements made by indigenous peoples internationally, wherever, back in our communities, all of the conferences that we have gone to over the past number of years, 15, 20 years, are starting to bear fruit. The Working Group on Indigenous Populations would not have come about had the indigenous peoples not taken an active role internationally, had not made declarations, had not put forth covenants, conventions, had not made resolutions, and had not lobbied. I think it's important that this continues, and I'm sure you will find that the report that comes out of this will be another added initiative to convince the international community to finally recognize, you know, the rights of indigenous peoples. And I think, if nothing else, I know, I guess this will be useful for the people in Alaska, but if nothing else, this the work of this commission is going to be a valuable aid in further development of rights internationally. And I'd like to thank the commissioner and the Inuit Circumpolar Conference for having invited me to take part at this session. And I want to say that the World Council of Indigenous Peoples will continue its involvement with the work of the commission. We won't end our work when the publication of the report comes out. We will do all that we can to ensure the publicity and the promotion of the report internationally at all the meetings that we're at, and we'll ensure that this issue stays alive. Thank you.
Thank you, Clem. Thanks very much. And I should say, speaking for the Commission, that we do appreciate that the World Council has been a co-sponsor of the Commission since December 1983. Of course, it was the ICC that established the Commission in the first place, and they've had the pulling oar when it comes to fundraising, but it has been of great assistance to be co-sponsored by the World Council, and we thank Clem and his colleagues at the World Council. I have two questions I just wanted to ask Doug Sanders while they're in my mind. You said that the United States hadn't signed any of the UN covenants that bear on the rights of minorities and indigenous peoples, that is, putting that expression rather, casting it rather loosely. What is the reason why the United States, there must be an official reason given for not signing. What is the reason? There must be a policy. Sandy, do you as an American want to answer?
Ratification. The Senate is the problem.
Sorry, go ahead.
The Senate is part of the problem. It depends on the administration. Even now, the administration wants to go through with the Genocide Convention, but there's Jesse Helms there in the, you know, the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, who, you know, has a long-standing opposition to that convention.
Those international conventions that. That are the equivalent of treaties, you have to have two-thirds of the Senate concur.
I think that's the case.
I see.
I think it's been a problem, too, with treaties that were signed with Native American people that weren't ratified by Congress. There's dozens of them, I'm told, from the state of California that were signed and that sat in archives and weren't discovered until the Indian Claims Commission started in 1946 because they were never ratified by the Senate. Am I right on that? I think so.
Well, certainly the conventions as treaties under U.S. law have to be ratified by a majority of the Senate. That's the constitutionally prescribed procedure before the United States is bound. However, I don't accept that as an explanation as to why the U.S. hasn't signed them. The Canadian practice on international treaties is that we seek in treaties which affect the jurisdiction of the provinces, which is very wide in the Canadian structure, we seek the consent of the provincial governments. The text of the two international human rights covenants was accepted or formalized by the General Assembly in 1966. Canada did not sign until 1976 because, and I think this is a more complex procedure than getting it through the Senate, which is we went to 10 provinces to get their consent before we signed, and that's why it took us 10 years. I think the United States has the problems of many great powers that they're parochial, that they do not regard the international level as being real. If you have power, you're not interested in an international legal order because you can make it on your own because you're powerful. Canada has the advantage of being relatively weak, and therefore we are more internationalist in our view than the United States, though we're not a great power and haven't been an imperialist power because we haven't apparently had the opportunities, although we've occasionally in our history lusted after a couple of colonies in the Caribbean because, of course, we have greater need of palm trees than the continental United States does, but we never succeeded in that. I think that's the key thing. But it's interesting to compare the behavior of the United States and the behavior of the socialist bloc countries, because the socialist bloc countries have signed all of the human rights treaties, but they don't sign any of the special implementation procedures, so that they will do state reports, i.e. the Soviet Union itself will file a report on reporting on its own compliance with documents like the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, and their representatives are subject to questioning by international representatives in the Human Rights Committee on whether their report reflects reality or not, in a context in which these international people can draw on non-governmental sources, publicly available information from human rights investigatory bodies. And so while it's not as effective as having a individual complaints procedure, nevertheless it does subject the Soviet Union to a public event in which international human rights experts question the country on its stated compliance with the standards that it has signed. There are other countries which sign not only the human rights documents, but also sign any of the special implementation procedural portions. Canada signs them all, and the Scandinavian countries typically sign them all. Nicaragua, interestingly, also has signed them all, and there is a fair number of adherence to the treaties themselves in Central and South America, and some examples of signing the optional protocols on individual complaints. Nicaragua and Uruguay, for some odd reason, are the two major examples that come to mind.
Orrin Young and then Robert. Yeah, Orrin.
Question just on this point. How much correlation is there between those nations that sign these documents and those that have and their record of, how should we put it? I don't want to use the word adherence because you're using it in a technical sense related to a document, but those that really do conform to the requirements of protection of human rights. Some of the ones you've mentioned have deplorable, dismal records on human rights.
Uruguay was particularly interesting because people in the Human Rights Committee couldn't figure out why the country didn't simply denounce the convention. I guess that it had some liberal spasm 10 years ago or something and had signed the thing. Tremendous series of complaints, individual complaints from Uruguay about instances of torture and imprisonment, and Uruguay, rather than simply saying, giving notice that they were pulling out, continued to reply to the complaints and the procedure ground on. Canada was somewhat embarrassed that the first batch of complaints against nation states linked us with linked Canada with Colombia and with Uruguay, which weren't the sort of company that we normally expected to hang around with. There's no answer to that at the present time. I think in terms of correlation, one could say that countries like the Scandinavian countries, where adherence is by all of the countries, that the standards of economic equality within the country are very high by international standards, and the respect for human rights are very good by international standards, although those countries have had immense problems with coming to terms with the claims of the Sami indigenous minority in the northern areas. While they have been extremely enlightened internationally, this part of the international human rights agenda, if I can put it in those terms, is quite recent and presented particular problems for them. So in terms of adhering to theories on the rights, the collective rights of peoples, the socialist bloc countries in many ways, in terms of theory, have been way ahead of everybody else. So in terms of judging them, in many ways, it's better to judge them in terms of their stated principles, adherence to those, as opposed to the stated principles in international law, which are not well developed at the present time. We don't yet have a consensus at the international level of the proper conceptualization, particularly, most clearly, in two areas, one of which is economic and social rights. I mean, the critiques by the socialist bloc countries of the Western industrial democracies is that, sure, you have concepts of individual rights, but you will have, you allow tremendous injustice within your economic system with high levels of unemployment which read out on a class basis. The West has typically said this stuff, while important, is not to be fitted into a human rights structure. And so you have a continuing debate, well established internationally, between those two viewpoints. As well, you have another debate which is more directly germane to what we've been talking about today, between whether rights should be perceived overwhelmingly in terms of individual rights or whether collective rights of groups, either as ethnic minority groups or as peoples with a right of internal self-determination, whether those should be an important component. You simply do not have at the present time a consensus at the international level of a balancing of the importance of these two items. If there was a consensus, why I go into this is that if there was a consensus, then it might be quite possible to judge standards of compliance. Without the consensus, we're still at a rather preliminary stage. You do have attempts at assessing compliance, number of non-governmental organizations. Indeed, the United States government itself, for the last number of years, does an annual report on compliance with human rights standards. But the criteria which are used in determining that would not be universally accepted as being complete in terms of the questions of adherence which should be examined.
Orrin Young and then David Case, you wanted to ask something.
I wanted to make an American supplement to the Canadian interpretation of American politics, which you just heard. And let me offer 3 points about this question that Tom has raised. The first point is this, that it is hard to get treaties ratified in the United States Senate. Whether it's easier or harder than in other places is a separate question. It is hard, and it's getting harder. It's getting harder because the post-war bipartisan foreign policy consensus that was operative in the United States in the late 40s and 50s and into the 60s is clearly breaking down. The diversity of viewpoints and the differences in value outlooks and perspectives that are reflected in the composition of the Senate is growing all the time, making it harder to put together a majority, a simple majority, for anything, much less a two-thirds majority. Therefore, in order to get a treaty ratified, it requires a fairly substantial act and exercise of political will. An exercise of political will means in this context is a willingness on the part of the administration to expend a fair number of political chips. They've got to want it badly